Hello, you, and welcome to You Are Good, a feelings podcast about movies. Today, we are talking about my best friend's wedding, and we are talking about it with the great Sam Sanders. I am one of your hosts, Alex Steed, and I will soon be joined by my marvelous co-host, Sarah Marshall. My Best Friend's Wedding is a 1997 American romantic comedy film directed by P.J. Hogan from a screenplay by Ronald Bass. The film stars Julia Roberts, Dermot Mulroney, Cameron Diaz, and Rupert Everett. Sam Sanders is one of the co-hosts of Vibe Check, which focuses on news and culture from a Black and queer perspective. The show is co-hosted by Sam, Zach Stafford, and Saeed Jones. And Sam also used to host NPR's It's Been a Minute. So we were delighted to be able to have this time to talk with Sam about My Best Friend's Wedding. Hey, if you're new to You Are Good, a feelings podcast about movies, you should know, here's what we do. We watch movies, and are we critics? No. Are we critical theorists? We wish we were. Sarah is, I think. I am I'm an amateur in that arena. We watch these movies and we say, what did this make me think about being a human being? What did this make me think about being alive in the world today? What did this make me think about my relationships with other people? We look at these movies through the proverbial feelings lens. That's what this show is all about. Just in case you're new and you don't know how it works, that's what we're doing. Hey, what's going on in your world? Let us know how you're feeling. Let us know what you're thinking about. Let us know what you've got on the agenda. Let us know what you're reading. Let us know what you're watching. Let us know what season of Gossip Girl you're caught up to. Let us know how it's all going over at You Are Good or You Are Good Pod, depending on which of the social media platforms we're on. We also are making reels, which have like little bits from the episodes, and you can also find those reels over on my TikTok at Alex Steed. We would love to hear from you. Tell us how you're doing. And don't forget that you, my friend, are good. You Are Good is made possible with and by your support. Thanks to everyone who supports us on Patreon and Apple Podcast subscriptions. Your support makes it possible for us to make the show. We're able to pay folks. We're able to make this part of our how we make a living. So thank you so much for doing that. We appreciate your support. And if you're not supporting us, hi, Tony. Tony the cat just jumped to my lap. If you're not supporting us over there, it's not too late. And if you do, you can get bonus episodes. Like we have a bunch of upcoming episodes. We just released a director's cut of our Crossroads episode, which is a nice sort of robust, juicy conversation about 2002's Crossroads. And later this month, we'll have a conversation about Mannequin 2 with our great friend River Butcher. So you never know what you're going to get, huh? Over in our bonus episodes. But that's what you get for supporting us. And just a little reminder that we appreciate you. Thank you. If you, like me, want to see a ceasefire, please get involved in actions in and around your neighborhood. You can find organizations that are organizing around that wherever you are. And if you're looking to share whatever resources you're able to share, please reach out to the folks at the Palestine Children's Relief Fund. I will have a link to that in the show notes. Oh, and one thing before we kick off. We had a little bout of audio gremlins in recording this episode. Sarah's first half hour, there was a blip. Who knows what happened? But we recorded a backup, and so we ended up using that bit of the backup for Sarah's audio. So it sounds, the first half hour, Sarah doesn't sound like she normally sounds in these episodes. Just letting you know, in case you're new, this isn't how our episodes normally sound. But it sounds good. You get a sense of what we're doing here, and thanks for your understanding. All right, I think that's it for this introduction to My Best Friend's Wedding. Now let's get into it with the great Sam Sanders and talk, let's talk Julia. Let's talk all things Julia. Hello, Sarah Marshall.
Cello, Alex Steed. No, Jello, Alex Steed. Oh my lord. Fabulous.
Is this Jello an allusion to a line in My Best Friend's Wedding?
Precisely.
I see you.
Who are we hearing from? Who is that?
Why, it's Sam Sanders, everyone. Hello, Sam
Hi.
Sanders.
Sorry I jumped in early. I was just, I'm excited about y'all and this movie and unhinged, evil, chaotic Julia Roberts.
This is another movie somehow I've never seen, and I didn't know it was about an evil person.
She's not evil. She's got a hard ear.
Okay. I saw this movie as a kid several times and loved it so much. I'm just like, well, Julia Roberts. And then I watched it again last night and I was like, oh, she's the villain. Jail.
It was a really, what a bold
it's
choice.
It's like Richard III without a wedding. It's perfect.
That's beautiful.
I like it.
Well, before we get into it, Sam, would you mind telling us some things about yourself and then maybe also telling us some things about your relationship with my best friend's wedding?
Yeah. My name is Sam Sanders. I am a podcaster and journalist originally from San Antonio, Texas. I live in Los Angeles now. Listeners might have heard me for years on various NPR shows. Right now, I host a show with two dear friends of mine called Vibe Check, where we talk about the culture and other things and laugh a lot and call each other sisters. It's really cute. But my relationship to Julia Roberts, you know, it's funny. To this day, I still call her one of the last Imperial movie stars, like Imperial. She had that run where, in the same way that like every summer you get ready for a Marvel blockbuster, in the 90s for a while, every summer you got ready for a Julia Roberts rom-com. And these things did numbers. Do you know the global box office gross from My Best Friend's Wedding?
No, tell us.
It's over $400 million for a rom-com, right?
And now a rom-com, they just are like, put it on Hoopla or whatever we're doing now.
Put it on StreamX or whatever the hell. Yeah. Whereas like she was making action movie money with rom-coms for a long time. And I grew up in this very isolated Pentecostal churchy upbringing where we kind of avoided anything secular. We just did gospel church stuff. But my mother loved Julia Roberts so much. She let us watch these movies. And I remember watching this with her as a kid and loving Julia Roberts. But now I'm like, oh. As I said earlier, she's the villain.
I love the exceptions that religious or conservative parents make where they're just like, well, I like it.
I like it. So let's do it. Yeah.
And my mom would show me like the craziest like sex films that she had watched as a college student in the 70s because she was like, they're from the 70s. So it's art.
This is also like the end, not the end, but we're approaching the end of an era of rom-coms that have very specific feeling 60s throwback soundtracks.
Oh, yeah.
Rom-coms singing for their supper, hoping for boomer nostalgia, and boy, did it work.
Well, and also rom-coms taking Burt Bacharach classics, one big one, which was sung by Dionne Warwick, and kind of like whitewashing it. Like, you literally don't hear a black person actually have lines until the wedding singer sings at the end of the film. And there's one black woman in the bathroom scene who's like, that's it.
Yeah.
Well, I was thinking about this when I was watching it, because I remember seeing this around when it came out. So I must have been like 10. And, you know, being the sort of thing where, like, even if you're like theoretically in the demographic that's being represented by these movies, you're still not, because it's about the top 1% of attractiveness generally.
Exactly.
I was like, man, it didn't occur to us to complain about it at the time. You would just like pick whatever rom-com star you felt vaguely aligned with and decide you were on the same team. And that was how I felt with Julia Roberts, because she had frizzy hair and was tall.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And a big face. Great movie stars have humongous faces.
Yeah.
Just all features.
So Hoping and Wishing and Praying, which starts the film, was sung by Dusty Springfield, who is white. But, however, Say a Little Prayer for You, which is that big scene at the restaurant, that was originally sung by Dionne Warwick. And I did have a moment where I was watching them all sing that, led by Rupert Everett, where I was like, oh, they made it white, like super white.
It's so white, actually, that he says Dionne Warwick and one of the people is like, who is that?
It's like, come on. She's the Valley of the Dolls.
Yeah, where is that? And then the only other detail I feel like we need to mention before we dive into plot is this is directed by P.J. Hogan. I didn't look any information up before. This is directed by P.J. Hogan, who directed one of my favorite movies and one of our favorite episodes, I feel like, was Muriel's Wedding.
Never saw it.
Oh my gosh, Sam, you are, if it ever happens, you're really in for a treat. And okay. What a run this director had, at least in two movies that have very, I don't know, funny views of marriage.
They're also just wedding movies.
Yes.
They're like trauma at the wedding movies, which is such
trauma
a great...
at the wedding.
And that's what, you know, that's what womanhood is about, really. And so that's how you serve the female viewer.
Speaking of trauma at the wedding, I was just talking about Rachel getting married. One of the most disturbing trauma at a wedding movies ever. But Anne Hathaway, oh my God. Anywho, I digress. Sorry.
It's a great genre. And there should be more... There has to be something like this, or maybe there like was something that I don't know, but like slasher movie set at a wedding.
Definitely.
That should be a whole subgenre. There should be 50 of them.
Yes. Does,
and you would not classify Ready or Not as that. That's a different kind of thing.
Oh, no, it's not a slasher. I feel like that's the thing that's at the back of my brain that I was trying to think of. But just more of it, you know, because weddings are one of the few remaining grand ceremonies in American life.
Yeah. Also, why not have murder at a wedding? Because a wedding is a kind of death.
Yeah.
Is it not?
Oh yeah. And also it's like you get to do the British country house mystery thing where everyone's forced to be in the same place, which you don't get a lot these days.
I want a whodunit at a wedding, and it was a wedding planner.
Because only Jessica would have known where everyone was at that time. And,
and
it's like revenge for everyone for fucking up her vision or something. Yeah.
Or the check bounced and fuck y'all. She's killing you now.
Yeah. Oh, Jessica.
Sarah Marshall.
Yes.
Would you mind taking us down the aisle, as it were?
I would be thrilled to. I also, Alex, did you notice that Rachel Griffiths, our friend from Muriel's Wedding, is in this film?
She, the one who gets her tongue stuck to David's penis.
Yep.
That was fun.
That was so fun.
He's an ice sculpture, to be clear.
Who among us? Who among us?
And as that gag was getting set up, I was like, oh, I like how they just did this on the phone and they gave us just enough information to like know that she was licking peen. And then
pan over,
we pull out and we get the full sight gag. And I was like, that was great.
It was better. Yeah. Subtlety is not always the way.
Yeah. This movie is not subtle.
No.
Oh my God.
Okay. So My Best Friend's Wedding is about Julia Roberts, established at the start of this movie and continuing the great trend of rom-coms not knowing how jobs work, is a food critic who everyone sees coming.
And she's a star critic at 28.
No, 27!
27!
And she delivers the verdict to their face.
Yeah. While the kitchen staff looks out the door in the back to see.
I was like, off to the races, baby.
And of course, we can't have people do jobs in a realistic way in rom-coms because then they wouldn't have time to be in a rom-com.
Yes, to sow chaos everywhere.
So Julia, food reviewer extraordinaire at 27, don't worry about it, is having a working lunch with her basically present day best friend, Rupert Everett.
Round of applause for that one.
Yes.
A man.
Straight from Maurice. Rupert Everett. And he is gay. And I feel like they're initially a bit subtle about it. And then I feel like by the end, it feels, I don't know. One of my questions is like, how many concessions had to be made to the ratings board, who inevitably at this time was like, you can't say someone's gay more than twice or else we'll give you an R rating or something.
Where I felt it showed the most is that even though he's gay and even though you kind of assume that he fucks, whenever you see him on his own, when Julia Roberts' character is calling him, he is with like 10 other people and not just with a man.
Right.
One scene, he is at a dinner party. Mm-hmm. The other scene, he's at a book reading. So he can be in spaces that feel gay, but you can't see him with a man being romantic.
But like Frasier gay.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. And there was a show in the early 90s, I completely forget what it was, but it was like something along the lines of like 30-something Melrose Place, you know, like grown-up primetime soap kind of a thing that like lost, I think, around $1 million in advertising for featuring two gay men in bed together, like I think implied post-coitally. And so many advertisers pulled out. It was like...
That's wild.
All the other networks...
pulled out, imagine. That's funny, because those two guys did it.
And so we have Rupert Everett subtly gay, and he gets to get our exposition where Julia Roberts is like, well, when I was a sophomore in college, I had this boyfriend for about a month, Dermot Mulroney, and then I decided to dump him. And he was like, I'm losing my best friend. And then we've been best friends ever since. And then one time 4 years ago, he like, what did he do with like, did they like become blood brothers or something?
It was like, if we're not married by X age, we'll get married.
Yeah. But it's so funny because they're like, if we're not married by the time we're 28, we'll get married to each other. And they talked about this. There's a recent Sentimental Garbage episode about this movie, which is great. And I was also struck by this coming back to it as a grown up who now looks back on 28 as like the finest flowering of my youth. But like when I was like 10 and first saw this, I was like, yeah, 28, that's like ancient. You should really get married if you haven't by then. And now I'm like, this is wild. But that's the plan. She's like telling the story to Rupert Everett. And then who should happen to get in touch but Dermot Mulroney? And he's like, hey, remember that time we decided to get married when we were 28 and how we're almost 28 now? Well, that's not why I'm calling. I'm marrying Cameron Diaz. She's 20 years old. She's a college student. Her dad's a billionaire, played by the butler from It Takes Two. And we want you to be in our wedding, which is 72 hours.
I think that this is what makes this movie so fascinating, is like, we'll cover the ways that Julia is wrong in her behavior, mm-hmm. led entirely by anxiety. Like,
yes.
She just is driven by anxiety.
But her hair is so cute, and so you love her.
Her hair is so cute. And we love her because she's America's sweetheart. It has been for like about 7-8 years at this point. However, to Sarah's point, however, he should not be marrying this woman.
Also, nor should he be giving her all of this exposition and expecting her to not experience some kind of shock.
Nobody's correct.
Also, what billionaire family pulls off a wedding in just a few days? You're a billionaire? Baby, it's destination. It's going to be like 6 months of wind up for the festivities. You really think billionaire daddy wasn't like, oh, we're doing a blowout and we need time? Doesn't make sense.
They got to get Condé Nast Traveler, you know, to cover the thing. That'll take a couple months.
Yeah, you got to write up the New York Times article, all these things. Yeah, it's also like, why are either of them in a rush?
And why could, I feel like it would have been realistic, although it seems like it's for whatever reason essential to note that he is a person who calls her all the time and she gets back in touch maybe once a month. And that's an interesting dynamic. But like, it feels like they could have handled this plot wise to be like, this has been in the works for a long time, but I've just been putting off calling you about it. But we didn't do it.
Nope.
And that's cool. Also, M. Emmett Walsh is in this movie, and it made me look up, as I do every time I see M. Emmett Walsh in a movie, is M. Emmett Walsh still alive? And he is 88 years old and just,
I feel like he should be 108.
He's immortal.
I feel like he was 88 years old when he was in Blood Simple 40 years ago.
That's exactly right.
Oh, that guy.
Yeah.
He's still alive.
Yeah. M. Emmett Walsh is still alive, everybody.
I'll have what he's having. Wow. He looks like a ghost.
I don't get news online anymore. I guess have dinner with Sophie Lichterman once a week and I hear about what's been happening.
And she lets you know if M. Emmett Walsh is still alive.
Yeah, and I'm like, Sophie, is M. Emmett Walsh still alive?
I must know.
Okay, so Julia gets all of this news. Her character in this movie is named Julianne, so I love that she's just Julia. Mm-hmm. It's just Julia being an absolute maniac, basically branded as herself. And I hope this was really fun to play. But yeah, she falls off the bed. She plays it cool. She meets up with, what's his character's name? Do we care?
We don't really care.
She goes to the airport to go pick up Dermot Mulroney and Cameron Diaz. And I had a moment of insane nostalgia for the time when you could just walk to the gate as a random person.
There must have been so much marital relationship, etc. drama at the gate as a result.
Oh my God. Yeah.
I remember when my parents would just send my 9-year-old ass to the airport. They'd be like, the nice lady's going to watch you on the plane until you get to your aunt's house. Remember that?
Oh yeah.
And they would give you little wings on your little sweatshirt. I'm wearing a wing, so don't kidnap me. Oh my God.
And I feel like now when a kid's flying alone, I'm sure there's like some stuff that they do, but it's like, with the way things are now, I really feel like the airlines are like, no, we will not take care of your fucking kid for you.
Yep. I want to say a flight attendant once, like, got me through a layover to the next plane.
Which, like, I, as a 40-year-old man, don't know what to do.
No one knows. So yeah, she picks up the happy couple. Cameron Diaz is like, I'm 20 and I'm smart and I'm wearing a sweater over my shoulders and I want you to be my maid of honor. And Julia's like, what? And she's like, yeah.
Also, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
That would never happen.
Yeah. A woman doing that, like, it has to be a scheme or a manic episode.
And I think we're led to, by the end, believe it's both. It's a manic episode that drove a scheme.
Do you think that your this relationship close. Is the result of a manic episode?
Yep.
Aren't most of them?
I recognize a lot of this behavior. Oh, yeah.
And so, yeah, so Julia now is embedded in the wedding. They put her in a lilac bridesmaid's gown, which actually looks great with her hair. You wouldn't think it would.
Well, and it's like there's this moment where she's in that gown where you're like, oh, there's no Jennifer Lawrence without Julia Roberts, because she does this thing where she's super hot in the dress, but then she rips it and then she's like, can I have a cigarette? And you're like, oh, this is the template. Like, hot girl, cool girl, but clumsy girl. Julia made the template.
I mean, I feel like it's so significant for understanding, and we've talked about this before in previous episodes, but it's so important to understand, like, the thing that made Julia Julia is that, like, her two sort of premier roles were hot townie in Mystic Pizza, mm-hmm. and then sex worker turned glam lady.
Yeah.
And that's, like, her range, is that, like, mm-hmm. she can be kind of, I mean, we now know her for being, like, glamorous Julia Roberts, but, like, I feel like part of the range is that she's, like, also the person you had a crush on at your high school who graduated in like 1987.
She's an around the way girl. Like, even yes. though she's like beautiful movie star, best hair in the world, you're like, oh, Julia Roberts also rips her dress and has a cigarette. Oh, yeah. Oh.
And it's like, no matter how terrible the things she does are, just her hair and her skin are so beautiful. You're like, she's still kind of crushing it. Yeah. Yeah. She looks good while she's doing all these terrible things.
Also, a lot of exposed midriff in this film from her, which I liked.
God, yeah. Yeah. And so she basically commences her scheme. She's kind of checking in with Rupert Everett over the phone in a series of increasingly dramatic calls.
Also, the emotional labor gay men do for the women in their lives. Woo, buddy.
Rupert Everett has so many things to do and places to be.
Yes.
God, she should. Well, maybe he presents her with a bill like right after the credits start rolling. But yeah, she makes an executive decision that she's going to win back Dermot Mulroney. And so, unfortunately, each element of her scheme merely drives the happy couple closer. She like arranges for Cameron Diaz to have to do karaoke, and then it becomes this like beautiful scene where Cameron Diaz, like, because people are often like, oh no, I'm not a good singer, and then they like do perfectly fine, but Cameron Diaz is like one of those people who like truly cannot sing and valiantly just like gets up there and does it and wins everyone over, and she sounds like a newborn lamb caught in a fence.
It's really bad. But it also, like, that moment made me pause and be like, oh, I don't think we give Cameron Diaz enough credit.
She's so good.
She's good in this movie.
She's like, I think the 90s between the, well, I guess I'll count 2000 as well, but like The Mask, this,
yes,
and Charlie's Angels,
There's Something About Mary,
like, and Something About Mary, God, what a run.
Yeah.
There's Something About Mary, I feel like, was like her big breakthrough movie, or like the movie where she became Cameron Diaz. Mm-hmm. You know, and yeah, she kind of superseded Julia Roberts, you know, in the kind of Hollywood Logan's Run scenario as the girl next door, and it went from girl who rips her dress to girl with cum in her hair. Yeah. To signify the change from the 90s to the 2000s.
Two things happened in the 90s that if you weren't around for, it's almost hard to believe. And one is the promotional image of a very popular movie was a woman with cum in her hair.
One of the most popular movies of the year.
And the second, within that proximity, was one of the most famous promotional images for a movie was a pie with a hole in it because someone fucked the pie.
Oh, American Pie. We were fucking horny.
Still are, baby.
Yes.
I watched There's Something About Mary when I was like 11, and that stuff just went straight over my head.
Of course.
I wasn't warped by it because I didn't understand it. Which
right, because it's a cartoon.
Advice to, you know, parents who are worried about their children seeing something kind of slapsticky and broad.
Yeah. So Julia continues her scheme. She keeps having these little moments with Dermot Mulroney that make it clear that he has feelings for her, but just not enough feelings.
Well, like the baseball game when she's carrying beer to everyone and then she walks away with a midriff and the breasticles are popping and she goes, I've got moves you've never seen. And you're like, oh my God, she does. She does.
Yeah. And she's like, she's going to confess her feelings to Dermot Mulroney and then it's not going well. And then Rupert Everett, God bless him, shows up to relieve her. And then she's like, and what I'm trying to say is that I'm marrying Rupert Everett, my coworker. Here he is now.
Well, and like, just as a testament to the really great writing in this film, when Julia Roberts is trying to explain why Rupert Everett is there and why this obviously gay man is her fiance, she's like, what does she say? She goes, oh, he just came in for a few hours to fuck me.
That was
and
great.
And Rupert picks it up. No skip. He goes, yeah, takes a few hours. So good.
I gasped when she said that. I was like, that works. That's great.
Yeah.
This movie almost got an R rating because of that.
Did it really? I'm sure.
Yeah.
I believe it.
We couldn't deal with the F word.
And then Rupert just comes in. This is what I found so interesting as like watching this now in adulthood. He's performing fiance in the gayest way and everyone must know, but no one cares. I think as a kid I saw it and I was like, wow, that's really convincing. It wasn't. Like, it wasn't. This fiance shows up and leads the lunch or dinner in a communal singing of a Dionne Warwick song. So gay.
Do you think the British accent throws Americans though? Like, I think when we meet British
people. We can't tell.
People,
gay or British. Yeah. We don't know. Gay or British. Never tell.
It really throws us, but totally. And just like what his role is in this 90s movie. And at the end of it, I was like, you know, the title could be from Rupert Everett's perspective.
Right.
Yes. Which would be My Best Friend is Crazy. That's what you're talking about. Or the movie, rather.
My Best Friend's Wedding Spiral.
I like the idea that we're seeing the movie from his like afar gaze, from his like surreptitious across the reception gaze.
Hypothetical. If we redo this whole movie from Rupert's point of view, what do we call the movie and who directs it?
Oh, that's a great question, Sarah.
Windy City, which I know is already a movie, but it's a metaphor. It's kind of like, it's very, very written, you know, there's soliloquies and it's directed by Stephen Frears.
That's great.
Okay.
Sam, what's your take?
I want it to be really dark and I want the entire energy of the film to be over the course of the movie. You realize the gay best friend is trying to organize an intervention for her because she's not well. And so like it's a like mental health, emotional drama.
Love it.
And the final scene is not the wedding scene. The final scene is sitting down Julia Roberts and saying, you have a problem. And I want it to be directed by, who does slow, beautiful brooding like that? Whoever directed Rachel Getting Married will direct this movie.
Nice. Oh, yeah, that is perfect.
Who directed that? I want to find out. Rachel Getting Married, 2008, of course. Oh, it's Jonathan Demme.
Oh, he's not available.
Is he? He's alive, right? No, did he die?
No, he died.
Oh. I want it to be so uncomfortable the entire time. Like so uncomfortable.
Yeah.
I want to call it Warwick.
Yeah.
And it's directed by David Lynch.
Ooh, okay.
And it's just a sideways, we're left wondering why.
Like why? Yeah. I like this.
He's like, it's a Dionne Warwick biopic. It couldn't be more straightforward. You're like, but why is it about some woman trying to destroy someone's wedding in Chicago? He's like, why wouldn't it be?
Yeah.
Well, and yeah, and so Rupert Everett is doing his best, and Julia's kind of last ditch maneuver that she kind of didn't mean to do.
Oh, hold on though. Hold on though. Once you break and enter, you meant to do.
Yeah.
You meant to do.
I know.
Yeah. Also, before that happens, Rupert, who's there for a bit, he then leaves, and either as he's leaving or just after, he tells her, he's not going to pick you, move on, right? Doesn't he tell her? He's like, girl, just be a friend. This is not going to work for you. And she doesn't heed this wise gay man's advice. Then she really gets like criminal.
Yeah. I mean, things could go bad for her forever based on what she did.
It's fraud. She could have gone to prison. That's what I kept thinking watching. I was like, she could have gone to prison. This is not legal.
And you're fucking with a billionaire.
Yeah.
You can't make a rom-com in the 90s without at least three felonies involved.
Yeah. Like Elon gets made fun of on Twitter and he like sues people.
Literally. Yeah.
This also has to be one of the first examples of a draft of an email being a plot point in something.
Where, yes, exactly. Where he's like, I drafted some email to his assistant. Yeah. I drafted some emails. Please send them out at 5.
Yeah. Right.
And like, basically, so like this all gets to the email situation because there's this back and forth over whether Dermot Mulroney McDermott, which, what is this man's name?
It is Dermot Mulroney. Yeah.
He's a sports writer who travels the country writing about sports. The billionaire family and Cameron Diaz want him to maybe not travel so much. And once they get married, take a job with the billionaire's company. And in that tension, Julia Roberts' character decides to send an email from the billionaire father's account urging Dermot's current boss to like fire him. Mm-hmm. Oh my God.
Yeah. Which is like, it's just so interesting to like be framing that as someone else's strategy. It's such a stupid maneuver, but she's not thinking well.
She's not. So. She's not.
And then she gets the wedding ring stuck on her finger, which is great.
And Dermot licks it off, sucks it off with his mouth. Just
it's terrible.
Yeah. Yeah. But at first she thinks she's not going to send it because she writes it. Then she says save to drafts. Then she leaves the room, the office, and you think it's all fine. But then the billionaire father comes back and he's to his assistant. He goes, oh, yeah. And be sure to send out all of my draft emails. Boom, boom.
Emails when this movie came out were so not urgent.
Yeah.
That you could just like write a bunch of drafts.
Yeah, send the drafts tomorrow, whatever. Oh, that's fine.
I mean, yeah, I just recorded an episode of The Sons at Prom about The Crush, ooh, which is a movie where Cary Elwes plays a journalist who at one point is pounding away on a nude article and it appears that he's drafting it on a sticky. They were just like, we can't show a word processor. It's too ugly. And so this actually does lead to a big fight where it seems like Dermot Mulroney wants to call off the wedding. Things seem to be going to plan, kind of, although it doesn't feel great. And so Julia follows him to the big, like, family brunch, the giant pre-wedding brunch, I guess, that people have.
Which is the same day as the wedding?
Right? Is that? Whatever. Yeah, and the wedding is at 6 p.m.
Yeah, wild.
So they just start, everyone has to be captive for at least 14 hours. Mm-hmm. And so she, you know, has a moment with him and kisses him, and wouldn't you know it, Cameron Diaz sees them and runs off, and Julia Roberts has destroyed everything. The scene I remember most vividly from when I was watching this as a kid is her stealing a truck and calling Rupert Everett from a flip phone.
Yes, and she exclaims while driving the truck, hair flipping, things are not going well. And you're like, yeah, damn straight. God damn it. Yeah.
She also has had along the way a very sweet exchange with Paul Giamatti where smoke together.
Another gaspable moment.
Yeah.
I heard his voice for a millisecond was like, Giamatti's here.
Yeah.
And then we spend time with him.
And I was so excited to see him show up as a like bellhop consoling Julie Roberts while she illegally smokes a cigarette in the hallway. But for a second, I was like, I really hope Paul Giamatti's character doesn't like make a move on her.
Yes.
And he didn't. So it's fine.
Yeah.
But I was worried for a second.
It was tense.
Yeah.
I would. The only thing this movie was missing was a surprise Philip Seymour Hoffman. That would have pushed me over the top.
I wanted Jesse Plemons to show up and then it become a murder mystery. Because you know when he shows up, crimes and misdemeanors, baby.
He's the guy whose van Julia took. And then Sam, what, I want you to bring us home with this story.
So at this point, Julia Roberts' character has done so many bad things. She tried to sabotage the bride-to-be in karaoke. She tried to lie through email fraud to get this guy to lose his job. She is just scheming and lying. And then at the end, she kind of just says she's sorry to everybody. And everyone's like, okay. So she does this like shuttle diplomacy where she goes back and forth between the bride to be and the groom to be. And she, of all people, smooths things over for them. And then after all this drama where she almost ruined the wedding twice, she gets to then deliver a speech at the reception in which she alludes to someone trying to break them apart.
And everyone's like, yeah,
it's like, ha, 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 ha.
We heard.
Insane. In what world does this woman, after doing all this dirtery, get to go to the wedding and still be the maid of honor?
Well, it's taken me a long time to realize that like the plots of these movies are supposed to represent growth that typically happens over like 2 to 3 years of like therapy and intentionality, you know, and not just like 4 days or whatever. But what I like that allowed for that to happen is the confrontation. And this feels the most significant to me is the confrontation between Julia Roberts and Cameron Diaz, where yes, absolutely, Julia Roberts has behaved horribly.
Yeah.
Again,
yeah.
Just driven entirely. She does this really interesting thing where like she's clearly kind of a person who like deals with like anxious avoidant attachment stuff. And then suddenly goes into just like the anxious attachment stuff where you're like, the more you try to get someone to be with you, the more off-putting you are and they don't want anything to do with you. Like that's the entire thing she's doing throughout this whole movie. But we get this great confrontation in the bathroom where of course she's done all of this terrible stuff. She has to acknowledge it because she's been called out in front of all of these women. But then she reminds Cameron Diaz that like she wasn't acting. She's like, I made you my maid of honor. And Julia Roberts is like, yeah, but like, why? Nobody asked you to do that.
She's like, so I could watch you.
Right, right.
So I could watch you, girl.
Exactly. And so like, we do realize that like no one has been behaving especially well, which is usually why like weird conflicts happen in the first place. And right down to like, he should never have proposed to this woman.
Yes. Well, this is the thing about My Best Friend's Wedding. When you look at it, it's like, from the start, especially visually and aesthetically, this film is giving an air of innocence. These innocent, pretty, well-to-do white people believing in a classic version of love and marriage. Mm-hmm. And as soon as you peel back the top layer, you realize they're all unhinged and hurting each other.
Yeah.
Unhinged and hurting each other. Cameron Diaz knows she shouldn't be with that man. He knows he shouldn't be with her. Julia is sowing seeds of just chaos. Like, none of them are actually good. I think I realized when the film was done, it's like, none of them are actually good. They're all bad, and none of them should be with people right now until they figure their shit out.
Rupert Everett's the only good person in this movie.
This is the thing, and he is the only lead character in this movie in which we don't actually know a thing about him besides he's gay, and he likes dinner parties and book readings.
Yes.
Meanwhile, he's the most centered, balanced character.
And he keeps appearing and disappearing as if he's Gandalf.
He is Gandalf. He's gay Gandalf.
Isn't every woman's best gay friend a kind of Gandalf?
Yeah.
A wizard of sorts.
And then you just get sent into Mirkwood on your own. And you're like, don't you want to come with me? And he's like, no.
I don't.
Yeah. Well, and then like at the end, when she gives a speech and you think she's just like resigned to be alone, who shows up to dance with her at the reception? Rupert Everett.
To save her.
To which my 10-year-old self was like, why can't she just be with George? And I stand by that, really.
I mean, I will say, the version of life that Julia Roberts ends up with is a better version of life. Not tied down by a marriage and a shitty man with a really cute gay best friend. That's kind of ideal. That's ideal.
Even though she's an ancient hag at 27 going on 28. But yeah, and you look at the, you know, the Dermot Mulroney Cameron Diaz marriage, and I mean, what are all these characters doing now?
Oh,
what do you both think about
great
that?
Great question.
Well, that all depends on whether or not Dermot got a prenup. That's the question.
Oh boy.
Yeah. I mean, I think that Dermot has been married at least two more times.
Oh yeah, and he's a fully like alcoholic by now. Like he is in and out of rehab. He has three kids by two moms at this point. One of the kids talks to him. He'll still tell you all about how he should have got that prenup.
Sarah, where do you think, Art, will you see these people later?
I think that Julia decided to just like have a kid on her own in the 2000s. And I think that she and George started an app at the right time and then sold it and made a lot of money. And now they have houses in the Hamptons that are next door to each other.
Mm-hmm. I like that.
Or Julia Roberts' food critic character becomes a foodfluencer, and her whole shtick is like empowered ladies making meals for one. And she's famous.
She probably has a newsletter on which she's like clearing 150 grand a month right now.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And good for her.
Good for her.
Because she's investing mm-hmm. a lot of that into heaps of therapy.
There you go. She needs it.
What's George up to?
His character is the only one successfully married.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Like, he has a beautiful husband, and they have the kids. And Julia Roberts is the godmother to those kids.
Yeah. And her kid is always going to be 30% less well-behaved than their kids.
Oh, totally.
Yeah. And Cameron Diaz is like...
She's a lesbian now.
Mm-hmm. And she makes jewelry out of pebbles that she finds on her long walks while she wears her Eileen Fisher shawls.
Good for her.
Okay, but so this movie, it came out, it's about a woman who does a series of increasingly unforgivable things and then ends up with nobody. It has calm. Arguably, it has very little rom. Mm-hmm. And yet, it's like one of the iconic rom-coms of the 90s. So what's that about?
Julia Roberts.
What is a rom? What is, in your view... And I'm asking this, I guess, of all of us, because I don't know the answer. Like, what in your view defines what a rom-com is?
Someone actually, I feel like I had a conversation with someone a few months ago. I forget if it's for work or for pleasure, but like they define the characteristics of like a romance novel. So a romance novel is only a romance novel if there is a happy ending. That's one of the characteristics. But I'm not sure the same is true for a rom-com. Although we do end up with a happy ending of some sort because there is a wedding, you know?
The thing that strikes me increasingly, like why I feel like this fits, is that a rom-com is usually a comedy of errors sparked by the crazy ways we act when either like actual romance is being engaged or the illusion of romance is being engaged.
Hmm. So it's like the com that is inspired by the idea of rom.
Yes.
Real or otherwise.
Well, and like what makes this one a little different, you think of like the quintessential rom-coms. It's two people who meet cute and at first are like, I hate you. I hate you too. And then by the end, they get married. And this one kind of turns it on its head because you have two people who could have, might have, were once in love with each other. And then there's a third, which he is going to marry. And then she has to fuck it up. Like, this is not the typical rom-com setup, but I think it's still a rom-com. It's obviously still a rom-com.
Yeah, and it's like made okay. All of the stuff that happens is made okay because at the end of the day, there's a beautiful wedding.
Yeah. Well, and I think all of it's made okay because of Julia Roberts.
Well, yes.
Yeah.
The size of her superstardom in this moment and that smile, that hair. They could have had a plot point in this movie where she kills somebody and you still be like, oh, I love her.
Yeah.
You know, love makes you do crazy things.
I wonder if this is also like a character study of someone with main character syndrome.
Yes. What? Yeah. Oh, say more about that because I agree so hard. Please.
Well, because this is like she's behaving as if she knows herself to be in a rom-com, but then the movie in a way isn't cooperating.
Oh, I love that.
Because she has these little schemes, but they all backfire. And she's like, I know we're supposed to be together. And rom-coms, as we've talked about recently, are openly preoccupied with fate and destiny a lot of the time. So she's like playing by rom-com rules. And then the real world is like, nope.
Yeah. Yeah, she is acting in a way where she full, not even, yes, is everything you just said, but it's like she does not believe A, that there are other people and consequences for the other people. She can't see that right now because she is so hyper fixated on what's happening. And to that point, you know, believes that she is immune to consequence.
Yeah.
As evidenced by any one of her actions.
Well, and it's also just like, I think what is a hallmark characteristic of the quintessential rom-com of that era, the 90s, maybe even the 80s and early 2000s, was that without question, the end goal was always ultimately wedding and marriage for life. Mm-hmm. And it was unquestioned that that was always the best way to live your life. Mm-hmm. There was no other option. You wouldn't be happy until you had this thing. And so I was thinking last night watching it, I was like, is our society at this point, decades into knowing how many folks get divorced and, you know, embracing things like polyamory, et cetera, like, could America sustain rom-coms that still do that? I don't think so, but I don't know.
Well, I think that that's why we're so confused about the present rom-com moment.
We're like, what is the rom that we are comming about?
Yes.
Right. And like, what are we trying to represent? There were like there was a couple minutes at the end of the aughts, beginning of the teens, of movies about, you know, eventually finding the one, but it was like a way sluttier journey, which is nice. Mm-hmm. And like, there are like different like approaches, but I think
you gotta be slutty when you're finding the one. Otherwise you'll just marry someone you went to high school with.
Just a one.
Yeah. You there.
So I think, I do think that like part of the just figuring out like what to do with this container that we did for, you know, 60 to 70 years, like what to do with this container with a series of organizational, let's say, existential crises about how romance works and lives and thrives after the, you know, hut initial meeting.
Yeah. Like, I wonder, you know, somewhere there is a great Gen Z rom-com writer director waiting to like have their big moment. How do they land the plane of their rom-com? Does it end in a polyamorous relationship? Does it end in co-parenting with their friends? Does it end in a multi-generational household with grandma as a matriarch? Like, I just feel like the thing that rom-coms are always asking us to accept as fate was like marriage, wedding, and a heteronormative nuclear family. And now everyone's like, ugh, no.
Yeah.
So like, can rom-coms thrive again in a moment in which more and more of us question that typical ending?
Mm-hmm. One of my favorite recent, I'm already fighting myself in it being a rom-com, but like one of my favorite recent like dramedy rom-coms, God, it came out like 8 years ago now, but did you ever see 20th Century Women, either of you?
Mm-mm. I didn't. And it was one of those films where I was like, I need to watch this. I know I'm going to like it. And I didn't.
It's like prestige-y and it's lovely, but it really is. It is this. And that it's like the way that a group of people who know each other, love each other and come into each other's lives. And sometimes they're coupled and partnered and sometimes they're not or whatever. But like, it's a portrait of that. Mm-hmm. And it's not laugh out loud funny, but there are a lot of funny moments. But I would love to see more movies like that. And I'm sure people will hear us saying this and be like, there are.
Well, then let me know because I want to watch it.
Yeah, let us know.
They are not on my Netflix For You page. I'll tell you that. Mm-hmm. Send them to me. I want a rom-com where divorced parents just live across the street from each other. And it's still cool.
Yeah.
Did Marriage Story almost end like that? I forget.
I don't know. I didn't see it. It looked too angry.
Yeah, it did.
Oh, God, it was a lot. It was so tedious.
All I knew about it was that Adam Driver shouted and like there wasn't enough coffee. There wasn't coffee in the fake coffee cups. And I was like, no.
I'm glad it exists. Maybe. I don't know. But there was something about it that was so triggering to childhood that I was like,
I'm glad it exists. Maybe. I don't know. Yeah. Alex Steed. And that's your DVD endorsement.
I will say that final scene of Adam Driver just singing Being Alive from Company.
Wow.
You're like, damn, Noah Baumbach's going through it.
Yeah.
He's going through it.
And he was.
Yeah. Flash forward to Barbie.
Have you both seen, Miranda was telling me about this, so I don't know how Miranda targeted the social media phenomenon was. Someone on TikTok learned, I didn't know this before either, that the lore around Punxsutawney Phil, the groundhog, is that the lore around that groundhog is that it's always the same groundhog because he's given an elixir of eternal life. But he has a wife canonically named Phyllis.
What?
Who isn't given the elixir. And so this guy learned about that and like wrote this very like Sondheim company sounding musical.
Oh my God.
That's like Phil singing to his groundhog wife about how he's going to live forever. And then people started duetting it.
Oh my.
With like Phyllis God. Singing back to him, "You can have the fame, Phyllis."
What? Is this
also why must we force the heteronormative patriarchy on groundhogs?
I don't know. And then because it like the need for heteronormativity forces the question of, is he marrying a succession of Phyllises, and is there like a Phyllis baby llama where you have to go see which groundhog Phyllis's soul has migrated into, you know, once she dies?
And Phyllis is voiced by Julia Roberts.
Oh my God.
Phyllis is Joanna Gleason.
Didn't we just get a Julia Roberts and George Clooney are divorced parents who have to like hang?
Yeah, yeah.
Sure did love it. Ticket to Paradise. My God.
Was it good?
I mean, for me, I'll always love her. It was fine, but I loved it.
I love it. I love those two. I'd watch them together in anything.
Right. What I liked about this movie is that like Julia Roberts, rom-com queen, figured out at her age now, she needs to be the parent of the people getting married and not the person getting married. Whereas J-Lo, to her credit, she still keeps making rom-coms where she's the bride. She will never stop being the bride.
I love
J-Lo
it.
Is going to be the bride at 75 years old in her rom-coms.
Yep.
And we'll all be in full support.
So I live across the street from my best friend from high school, and occasionally, you know, that will come up and people will be kind of in awe of that fact. And if I were like, I'm married to the love of my life, which I'm not, but if I said that, people would be like, yeah, whatever. But if you're like, I live across the street from my best friend, they're like, oh my God.
So cute.
Yeah. And I think you need many kinds of relationships to sustain you, just like man cannot live on bread alone, although he can live on potatoes alone for quite a long time.
Huh.
I feel like the thing that we clearly in America today are starving for is relationships and community and homosocial bonding.
Yeah.
Which can, you know, lead to abandonment of heteronormativity, which I suspect is why culturally we don't allow for it past the age of 18.
Mm. Yeah. I just feel like, and maybe it's because I heard a podcast where they talked about it, but like the whole argument was like, we've spent decades putting so much investment into the idea of marriage as the ideal partnership that Americans have forgotten how to have friends. We've forgotten how to have friendships and be close to our friends and build community. So much of the energy and focus is like, build your marriage, work on your marriage. And then like, it's work, it's work, it's work. And you build that, you build that, you build that. And meanwhile, you don't have friends.
Yeah. Well, I think it's absolutely for sure that multiplied by year since Facebook was introduced. The digital drive towards how capitalism works is like through like straight up alienation between you and your friends, your family, et cetera. So all of what you just said, and also there is like an incentive to like not hang out with people in real life.
Oh yeah. I'll have people online. We were really close friends 10 years ago. I've just spent the last 10 years liking their posts, and I still think we're good friends. No, we're not. I just like your post, you know, and it's like we all don't realize how much friendship we've given up, I think.
Yeah.
I the other day was looking through an Instagram that like least interacted with people.
Mm.
And there was a person who I saw on there and I was like, I don't know. We just literally in my brain, I was like, we just, and I realized the last time we had brunch was in 2014.
Fuck.
But Alex, that was 3 years ago.
Right. That was what my brain did. But we just, nope. They've lived a whole fucking life since then.
Yeah.
Yeah.
As have I, too.
Can I bring up a pet peeve I had about one of the final scenes of the movie?
Of course.
Yes.
Total sidewinder, or whatever the word is. So when Cameron Diaz sees them kiss and then runs away, Julia Roberts ends up finding her at what I believe is the baseball stadium her father owns. Because he owns a team, right? Does he own the team?
He owns the White Sox.
So he owns a team, perhaps not the stadium, but like they've got box access. Why does Julia Roberts find Cameron Diaz in the GA bathroom stalls? Cameron Diaz would be in the box. She's not using the public restroom.
She's so upset that she's trying to escape by hiding amongst the plebeians. While we're talking about side things, there's like, so much of what makes movies like this work is the journey. And during the kind of pre-wedding brunch scene where Julia and Dermot are trying to get to the bottom of things, there is just like a trio of teenage boys who've just inhaled a bunch of helium singing Annie's Song by John Denver a cappella.
That was funny. That was funny.
So why, Sam, this movie? Why is this a movie that you were like, this is worth talking about?
I mean, everything Julia Roberts did in the 90s deserves to be studied, because we may not ever have a movie star who does what she did that well, that successfully, that long ever again. Mm-hmm. Like when you think of The Run, mm-hmm. multiple 90s rom-coms that grossed hundreds of millions of dollars worldwide, and not just rom-coms where she's like the damsel in distress, rom-coms where she's fucking shit up and is a criminal and it still worked. Mm-hmm. I just love getting into like the metaphysics of why Julia Roberts as a rom-com star always works no matter what. So for that, I also am obsessed with looking back on the way the culture toyed with notions of public homosexuality in the 90s, thinking it was progressive mm-hmm. when it was actually regressive. Like, all right, you got Rupert Everett in your movie and you call him gay, but you give him nothing besides tropes of dinner parties and book readings. And like, just like the time capsule of it all, I love. But I don't know. I'm kind of a sucker for Julia Roberts. I'd watch her do anything. I even like Leave the World Behind, the new one she did. I even like that.
We haven't even discussed the fact that the cover for Dermot, I'll go with that, knowing that Rupert Everett is gay and being like, oh, I thought I heard that he was gay, is his cover is like, I just tell people I'm gay because women love it.
Oh my God.
I was like, all right, I'll take it.
Everything about Rupert Everett's sexuality, it only exists if we can talk about it in proximity to straightness. Mm-hmm. He only exists as a tool for Julia Roberts. His sexuality can only be digested in proximity to straight women. Like, yeah, it's very interesting. It's very interesting. That's it. I still love the fucking movie. I still do.
Yeah, it is a romp.
I feel like my main question is, and maybe the answer is contained within the question, but why is it that the 90s were such an extremely judgmental time when we specifically love to torture women in tabloids without ever asking the question, how did this go from her perspective? Mm-hmm. And then in our rom-coms, all we wanted was women who, through a series of events, made it seem, because it is very relatable and understandable and human, to just kind of really commit a lot of crimes in a row.
Yeah, crimes. For a man who was just hot.
Yeah.
He didn't seem that smart to me.
No, he seemed to bring very little.
Very little.
An extension of that question is like, what do we make of the fact that this movie opens with Wishing and Hoping, and that song's just all about conforming yourself to the man's interest? Mm-hmm. And it's a very weird statement song for what eventually happens.
Yes. Well, I was watching it last night and that struck me from the start. So I turn it on, opening credits come on, and it's just these three white girls singing. One is in a wedding dress. He's barking. Didn't even say anything. Sorry. And I said out loud before I could even think, I was like, oh, this is not for me. This is not for me. Nothing about this is for me. Mm-hmm. And still, I licked it up. You know, I wonder, like, did we all know anyway? Were we all watching these movies in the 90s knowing it actually wasn't for us? It was a fairy tale that wasn't real and we still just liked it. Like, did we actually earnestly believe in the rom-com dream the whole time? Or did we actually in our heart of hearts know it was bullshit while we watched and enjoyed it? I can't tell.
Well, I did, but I was 11, so, you know.
But it's also no different from an action film. Like, it's like, no one is going to act that way in an action film. Things are never going to be that tidy. Like, no one is going to be that brave. Like, mm-hmm. it's going to be a mess. But it's a idyllic fantasy, just in a different direction.
I think Hot Fuzz is pretty accurate.
No one can dodge all the bullets the whole movie.
Right. Mm-hmm. Rom-coms are about dodging bullets.
Emotional bullets.
I feel like part of the discomfort of Ang Just Like That is that it's like, it is trying to be a modern day rom-com. And because Sex and the City was like a rom-com sitcom, I would say, really, with enough, you know, tits and ass to distract us from mm-hmm. the sort of traditionalness of what we were doing. And then I just like that as doing everything, I think, in an apologetic and defensive mode, which is why so many of the characters are so annoying. And I feel like there's a sense of, I don't know, people trying to write the rom-com of today of approaching it in an attitude of fear and this idea of not wanting to piss anyone off. And it's like, no, that's not, people aren't like waiting to get angry. They just want to be represented in a sincere way. And exactly. That's what it would be nice to see.
Yeah. Well, and it's like sometimes when the rom-com tries to be too woke, it becomes toothless.
Mm. Yeah.
You're just like, all right, no one's offending anybody. No one's unhinged. No one's making a mess. And everyone is just so concerned about everyone's feelings. It's like, we don't actually behave like that.
Right.
Yeah. And what I do like about any of the movies that we've talked about that have these rom-com elements is like, I do really appreciate this take where it's like, you think what you're going through is love or through one is one thing. You have done no work to disentangle what your feelings are from like specific kinds of like anxious or manic responses. Mm-hmm. And you're leaning into that.
Yeah.
And then like shit happens as a result.
Yeah.
And it requires some people to be unlikable. And I love a movie.
Totally.
And I loved this. Like, I love that like she is unlikable. I love unlikable. I mean, the totality of reactions. I love when we are presented with somebody who it's like, it's easy to understand, but kind of hard to redeem.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I like that a whole lot. I like there to be people who I'm like rooting for even against my best interests.
Right. Yeah. I find it so interesting to watch this movie just after I zoomed through Donald Glover and Maya Erskine's reboot of Mr. and Mrs. Smith on Amazon Prime Video. Because one, this show's actually really good, really fun. And I think it works because Donald Glover isn't allowed to be so tedious like he usually is because there's just so much plot. The plot has to move when you have no time for just like rumination, which he loves. Anywho, though, this show, it's an 8-part series, two spies who are married to each other. Some of the most powerful scenes are the two of them in couples therapy. And I feel like so much of the energy around how we talk about romance right now is couples getting married and then realizing the hard work about it and talking about that and showing that. Like, we see so many movies and TV shows where couples are in couples therapy. That was not happening in the 90s. Mm-mm. Like, Julia Roberts could have been calling her therapist. Instead, she calls her gay best friend, right? And so, I don't know. It's just like, there is an additional cast of characters to romance that didn't exist in the 90s. Now there's a therapist involved.
Right.
Now there's a support system involved.
It's the, yeah, it's the post-Sopranos.
Yeah.
It's like a crime boss shouldn't go to therapy. And then similarly, it's like, well, if you're in love hard enough, you wouldn't have to go to therapy.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, imagine if there were a therapist involved in the plot of My Best Friend's Wedding. What would have happened then?
God, it's so true, because even in Sleepless in Seattle, it's Rosie O'Donnell playing that character.
Yeah, who is also queer-coded. Stop making your gay friends your therapist.
Mm-hmm.
We have problems, too.
Well, this is kind of like what, I mean, it's in a much different way, and he becomes the villain. It's like, what about Bob is, where it's like what if, like, the zany character, actually, we saw their therapist sometimes, and it turns out that, like, he melts their brain.
Yeah.
That's what would happen to the therapist who has to deal with this fucking mess.
Uh-huh. What is the show where Uzo Aduba is a therapist in treatment?
Oh, yes.
I want Uzo to be Julia Roberts' therapist and just shut it down like 5 minutes in. She's like, movie's over. You're not going. No. I will see you on Monday in my office.
I want a rom-com about the gay best friend support group where they all have to meet once a week and talk about.
It's called WeHo. A lot of alcohol involved.
Oh my God.
See, that's a show.
Yes.
Is there anything we want to cover before we get to our wrapping question?
The bride in the opening sequence is wearing the same wedding dress as Rachel Green in the pilot of Friends. I think that's really fun.
Oh my God. Sarah, do you want to ask the question?
Sure. In this movie, Philip Bosco plays Cameron Diaz's father, but who in this movie is the daddy?
I am going to pick Rachel Griffiths, who isn't in this movie for a long time, though she's one of my favorites from Muriel's Wedding and 6 Feet Under. I especially, we talked about the joke at the beginning.
She's not a lie. She's with Muriel. She's
the best. We talked about her a bit at the beginning with regard to the joke where the sight gag is she gets her tongue stuck to an ice sculpture of David, specifically his penis. And I think she's, I think like she and the other girl are from Nashville, which is like perfect. But I just like the idea of how bold this person is coming to this wedding and at brunch, at the wedding, like isn't probably, I was going to say not, maybe not that drunk, but I know how these things can go. She's already licking the ice sculpture and getting in trouble accordingly. I love this bit.
Well, sometimes you try and do a covert little lick and then your tongue gets stuck and then suddenly it's a big event, you know?
Yep. No pictures.
Just happens.
Sam, who was the daddy of this movie as far as you're concerned?
Rupert Everett was daddy. He was the hottest one. He was the most well-adjusted. He's the one who spoke the most truth. He was the funniest. He's daddy.
Yeah.
He's daddy.
I feel like it would be willfully obtuse to choose someone other than Rupert Everett, who's also able to do so much with so little screen time.
Yeah.
But I guess I'll say Burt Bacharach.
There we go.
Because without him, this movie would not exist in the form that it does. It would be some wholly other movie. And could it? Could the balance work? We don't know.
We don't know.
We'll never know.
Yeah.
All right, everybody, that is it for this week's episode of You Are Good, a feelings podcast about movies. Thank you so much to our wonderful guest, Sam Sanders. Thank you for listening. Thanks, Miranda Zickler, for editing and producing this episode. Thank you for following us on social media at You Are Good or You Are Good Pod. Thanks for supporting us at Patreon or Apple Podcast subscriptions, where, of course, you get bonus episodes. Thanks to Fresh Lesh for providing the beats that make our episode sound so sweet. We appreciate you, Lesh. Thanks for writing a review over on Apple Podcast subscriptions or anywhere else. But that's like the big one, I guess. That's the one that, I don't know, is helpful in some way. All right. I think that's all you need to know from us over here at You Are Good for this week. I hope that you have a fabulous day, a fabulous weekend, a fabulous whatever's before you. And I hope that you do not forget that you, my friend, are good. We'll talk with y'all soon.